From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
And you can rest assured that I will adhere to every order and every instruction that this court indicates for me to follow. And that's my word as a Vietnam vet and as a man.
Former Black Panther Geronimo Pratt is free after 27 years in prison. This after evidence surfaced that his accuser was a police and FBI informant. We go back to the Pacifica Archives and bring you the documentary, Me and My Shadow, about the FBI's counterintelligence program, which aimed to wipe out, among others, the Black Panther Party.
District Attorney Carroll asked me, I think, one question. What did I know about the Panther Party at the present time? And I think I asked him which one, either the police department's Panther Party or the Panther Party, you know.
There are mountains of evidence that those individuals, some of whom have been revealed, others of whom have not, acted in ways to provoke confrontations between the party and the police and other armed elements of the power structure. The Black Panther Party considers 26 members, former members, as martyrs, having fallen in the course of the struggle, the history of this organization.
All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Majority Republicans thwarted Democratic attempts yesterday to spend more to help low-income elderly people afford doctor's coverage and pushed a bill revamping Medicaid and Medicare toward approval by a House subcommittee. Separately, the House Ways and Means Committee, working into the night, adopted a GOP-written measure changing the government's welfare program, narrowly voting to eliminate coverage for many legal immigrants who become disabled in the future. Meanwhile, standing on the island where millions of immigrants entered the United States, big city mayors urged Congress to restore benefits to immigrants that were slashed in last year's welfare law. The bipartisan alliance of mayors from New York, Los Angeles, Philadelphia, Seattle, and metropolitan Miami yesterday also called on the federal government to cut the backlog of citizenship applications and ensure immigrants remain eligible for public housing. They were standing at Ellis Island. In government hearings on online privacy yesterday, consumer advocates and regulators cast a harsh light on the practices of electronic data companies, questioning if they're doing enough to protect the ordinary Americans whose detailed personal information they gather. In an effort to head off strict government rules, LexisNexis and seven other search services unveiled voluntary guidelines to limit the personal information they assemble. The U.S. House of Representatives yesterday unanimously approved an amendment condemning human rights abuses committed by Indonesia in occupied East Timor. Rhode Island Democrat Patrick Kennedy introduced the amendment to the Foreign Policy Reform Act. He said yesterday's unanimous vote would serve as a launching point for further action against Indonesia. Kennedy also introduced a bill calling for the elimination of military assistance and training funds to Indonesia unless human rights violations are halted, which may come to the House floor for a vote later this month. And this news from Connecticut. A high school senior in Waterbury, Connecticut, who refused to pledge allegiance to the U.S. flag, has been inducted into the National Honor Society. Tisha Byers' induction came under a federal court order after a judge ruled that keeping the girl out violated her civil rights. She says she will not recite the pledge because she believes there is no justice for blacks in the United States. The court order is temporary. Byers will need a court's permanent ruling to be a National Honor Society member for life. And you're listening to Democracy Now!
Best education, loved by young and old, each and every generation, fought Vietnam trained with green beret till the secret war turned here the game. Came home to find he fought in the wrong military. Truth turned him into a revolutionary. He gonna teach my people how to defend themselves. Show them the other side of the white man's hell. Self-defense will keep us alive till we can figure out how to straighten our lives. Help my people, that's number one. Show them not to have fear of the gun. For his people, a fighter to the enemy of...
A song about Geronimo Pratt outside his courtroom yesterday. After 27 years in prison, former Black Panther Party leader Geronimo Pratt is free. To loud cheers from his family and supporters, Geronimo walked out of a Santa Monica, California courtroom yesterday after a judge released him on $25,000 bail just 12 days after reversing his 1972 murder conviction. Judge Everett Dickey ruled after hearing new evidence that the chief witness against Geronimo Pratt was a police and FBI informant who lied under oath. Chris Richard was at the courtroom yesterday. He filed this report for Pacifica radio station KPFK in Los Angeles.
Our bail will be set at $25,000.
It was a joyful scene at a Santa Ana courtroom as Superior Court Judge Everett Dickey granted a request by Pratt's defense team and set bail at a figure matching the quarter century Pratt spent in prison. Ever since his conviction for a murder during an $18 street robbery in Santa Monica, Pratt has claimed that he was a victim of a law enforcement frame-up, and evidence has steadily mounted that he might be correct. First, his defense team uncovered evidence that the former Black Panther leader had been targeted in the infamous FBI program dubbed COINTELPRO, a program of dirty tricks launched in the late 1960s and aimed at destabilizing anti-war and black power groups. They uncovered evidence that FBI agents may have known Pratt was attending Panther meetings in Oakland on the day of the killing, but concealed that knowledge. Then, last year, district attorney's investigators acknowledged that the star prosecution witness against Pratt, former Panther Julio Butler, was a paid informant for their office. During the original trial, Butler had claimed that he had never been a law enforcement informant. A state panel asked Judge Dickey to investigate the new revelations, and Dickey set an evidentiary hearing to determine whether Pratt should get a new trial. During the hearing, Pratt's attorneys established that Butler was an informant not only for the DA, but for the Los Angeles Police Department, the Sheriff's Department, and the FBI. 2 weeks ago, Judge Dickey said the jury needed to know that to render a fair verdict. He ordered a new trial. Today, Pratt stood in court to offer thanks.
Good morning, Judge Dickey. I just wanted to thank you from the bottom of my heart for your fair and courageous ruling and assure you that any further proceedings in this case, I'll be the first one here because I've been trying to resolve the merits of this case for all of these years to find out who killed Mrs. Olson, not any technicalities to try to put it off. And I am so happy that you've given me this chance to finally expose the truth about who killed Mrs. Olson. And you can rest assured that I will adhere to every order and every instruction that this court indicates for me to follow. And that's my word as a Vietnam vet and as a man.
After bail was set, an exuberant Johnny Cochran, Pratt's attorney at the original trial, called his client a model of courage.
I think you can see where it's so very heartfelt that the picture of Geronimo Pratt that's been put out is not an accurate picture. What he is really is an American hero. He is a decorated veteran. He is a person who has character and integrity, and in the face of this wrongful conviction, where the state used its mighty resources to convict him unfairly, he never wavered in his innocence. And you saw at the end when he spoke, the strength that emanates from this man. And I think that he can be a real positive force in this country as we move forward. When you are falsely accused, to have the strength and the endurance to spend your first 8 years in solitary confinement, he did what some of us only talk about. And so we're real proud to have had the opportunity to represent.
But Stuart Hanlon, who also has represented Pratt for the last quarter century, called today's ruling a mixed victory.
It's a great day for justice and for Geronimo, but it's not a great day for our legal system. People have said, does this justify the legal system? And the answer is no. The legal system that kept him in jail for 27 years for something he didn't do could not be justified by one judge having the guts to do the right thing. So we are exuberant today. It's been a very long struggle, but it's a great ending. We're writing the final chapter. The district attorney is not writing the last chapter. The police department is not writing the last chapter. We are. Geronimo Pratt is writing the last chapter of his story, and it starts today in Orange County when he leaves. And we say to everybody, right on, let's go get him out.
In 1972, COINTELPRO apparently was succeeding in destabilizing the Panthers. The organization was riven by factionalism, and the internal tension was rendered even worse by Panther founder Huey Newton's drug abuse. Kathleen Cleaver was one of very few Panthers to defy Newton's orders and testify in Pratt's defense. She swore then that he was in Oakland attending Panther meetings around the time of the killing, but she couldn't remember exactly whether Pratt was at the meeting on the day of the killing. Only 2 years ago did other Panthers step forward to solidify Pratt's alibi. Cleaver says that over the years, she's grown weary of the legal system treating Pratt's case as different from all others.
What I said is that the time that I've observed the way the courts have handled this case, it has never been treated as a matter of law. It's been treated as an aberration, and as if the law doesn't apply because this is a Black Panther threat to society and we can just ignore the law. Finally, I've seen a judge who is willing to treat this case as a legal matter and apply the law as it existed before he was tried.
Why couldn't it happen in L.A.?
Because it's a political cesspool driven by hatred and paranoia of Blacks in general and Panthers in particular.
But today, Pratt's family focused on their immediate joy. His wife, Ashaki, already is making plans.
I feel wonderful. Wonderful. It's been a long time coming. I was thinking about how long it's going to take us to get him out of there so we can get to my daughter's graduation.
As for Pratt, he too says he wants to move forward. Moments after walking out of the Orange County Jail, he urged the public to remember the plight of other prisoners, notably Native American activist Leonard Peltier, who has been incarcerated for nearly as long as Pratt. And Pratt says he bears no hard feelings against his old adversary Julio Butler, the former Panther who played a pivotal role in winning a conviction against him a quarter century ago.
What do you have to say to Mr. Butler?
Huh?
What do you have to say to Mr. Butler?
I wish him well, and I hope that he can wake up out of that stupor or whatever he's in and begin telling the truth about his puppet role, his house Negro status, and so forth and so on, and come and tell the truth. And even if he's done, the truth is going to come out. It took me 26 years.
Right now, Pratt says he only wants to catch up on his family life. His 14-year-old son, Hiroji, graduates from middle school next Friday, and his daughter, 18-year-old Shona, graduates from high school in Marin County today. At the jailhouse gate, Pratt jumped into a waiting car for a dash to the airport. He says he wants to be present at that graduation. This is Chris Richard reporting for KPFK.
Thank you for that report, Chris. In fact, Geronimo Pratt never made it to that graduation because he didn't have the photo ID he needed to get on the plane. Instead, he and his daughter and son and family and friends celebrated at George's Restaurant in Melrose in Los Angeles. Also, Julia Butler, the man who's been identified as the FBI and police informant, word has it that he has just resigned as chair of his Baptist AME church in California. We'll talk more about the counterintelligence program in just a minute, but we wanted to bring you some unedited clips from outside the courthouse yesterday when Geronimo Pratt was free and mobbed by media and supporters.
That I'm innocent of any crimes of murder, and expose the truth of COINTELPRO,
right,
and
right,
illegal practices of the Hoover Nixon regime.
That's right.
So I want to thank you again.
Thank you.
I want you to have this. What are you going
to
be doing next?
How does it feel to breathe free air?
It's hard to describe. You know, for 27 years, and they did me the worst thing that you could ever conceive. And I still have brothers like Rochelle McGee, Hugo Pernell, that's still
right
in the hole.
That's right.
And
they
have
right
no reason in the hole. Beautiful brothers. Romaine Fitzgerald, the only Panther we lost to death row for a murder he didn't commit, and everybody in the community knows it. And that's one thing I want to say. When someone like Johnny Cochran comes right and tell you that I'm representing this man from the community, that means the community has empowered him. Johnny knows what's going on. Johnny is deeply rooted in the community. So all of this that Garcetti is saying, I contribute to the power of the people, that the continuing struggle, that we will never relent when we're faced with injustice. I can contribute personally to Stu Hanlon, to Johnny Cochran, to everyone who, you know, was personally involved and throughout all of the years. And it wasn't an easy struggle.
What are you going to do now? What's the first thing you do?
Well, I want to go do a sweat with my native brothers. I need to detoxify. I need to get these poisons out of my system.
Get a good meal.
I need to see my mother. Every time I left home, I've always gone back. I'm a mama's boy. My mama's 94 years old. And I need to see her.
What kind of help? What kind of health is she in?
Continue this fight if the DA appeals
this ruling. Yes. In fact, I would love to have a new trial because we are fighters now for Mrs. Olson. All these years, no one cared who killed Mrs. Olson but us. We tried to deal with the merits of the case. They only wanted to deal with the technicalities to get out of it. Now, Judge Dickey has given us a chance to finally lay bare the facts and when everyone can see who killed Mrs. Olson. And I am committed to that end because the woman was a progressive person. She was savagely killed and thrown to the dogs, and everyone forgets that. We're not going to let that be forgotten because the truth is going to come out. And it's ugly. A lot of it has come out already. But more is going to come out about the truth of these murders and other murders.
You got a message for the young people who were born when you went into jail who've been out there saying free Geronimo.
Well, I just left with quite a few of them in prison. 25 years
Oh, raised in a good home, best education, loved by young and old, each and every generation. Fought Vietnam and trained with Green Beret till the secret war turned to the king. Came home to find he fought in the wrong military. Truth turned him into a
Geronimo Pratt. Free after 27 years. His family and his supporters have always maintained that Geronimo was targeted and framed by the FBI and the LA Police Department because of his activity in the Black Panther Party. And after a 27-year-long struggle, that view prevailed 12 days ago in a Santa Monica courtroom. Judge Everett Dickey threw out the conviction because the main witness against Geronimo, Julius Butler, was an FBI and police informant who lied under oath. Today, we're going to take an extended look at the U.S. government's and specifically the FBI's illegal and murderous war against the Black Panther Party and other groups that were fighting for social change from the 1950s through the 1970s. The counterintelligence program, known as COINTELPRO, as the war was officially known, claimed many lives and many more were thrown in prison for extended periods of time. People like Leonard Peltier, Sylvia Baraldini, and Geronimo Pratt. The special radio documentary called Me and My Shadow was produced by Addie Givens in the late 1970s, just as the outline of the government's secret war against the left was beginning to emerge. For the rest of today's show, we're going to play you excerpts of that documentary, Me and My Shadow.
Do you ever get the feeling you are being watched? If you are active in any organization on the left, you probably are.
Another great story based on Frederick L. Collins' book, The FBI in Peace and War. Drama, thrills, action.
In the name of national security, the FBI has paid thousands of civilians to join, spy on, and subvert perfectly legal organizations working for social change in this country. David Sanis, Mary Jo Cook, and Sarah Jane Moore have all served as FBI informers.
I went into a relationship as an undercover operative for the FBI under the assumption that I would be seeking out to bring to trial individuals who were engaged in political bombings. After I had been in the FBI a number of months and had performed with some success for them, I was instructed to begin actually seeking people out to conduct bombings and actually be an individual who would lead a series of bombings. That struck me as slightly unconstitutional. I was also involved in an FBI agent-directed conspiracy to obstruct justice in three important radical cases in the Seattle area. And that seemed a little odd, specifically that the Federal Bureau of Investigation, sworn to uphold the Constitution and Bill of Rights, was systematically attempting to obstruct justice to defy the provisions of the Bill of Rights, etc., in three important cases.
What was explained to me was that I was to serve my country in a certain capacity. And the terms of that capacity was I was to be a safety valve, a voice of reason. And other than that, they wanted to know who people were, where they lived. They wanted identification of people. They wanted to know if people had emotional problems. They wanted me there as a woman and functioning as a woman.
What did your informant consist of? What kind of information were you passing on?
In terms of the reports that I filed on this particular man, the answer is everything. Every phone call that I made to him or that he made to me, the meetings that we had, where we met, why that place was chosen, what we talked about, not only political content, but what we talked about in terms of just social conversation, even to the...
You're listening to the radio documentary Me and My Shadow, produced by Addie Givens. When we come back, we'll go back to the program. We'll be back in 60 seconds. This is Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman as we continue with Me and My Shadow, a radio documentary produced by Addie Givens, exploring the FBI's assaults on the Black Panther Party, the American Indian Movement, and anti-war groups fighting for social change. It was produced in the late 1970s.
To free the nation from the ever-changing, always ominous red menace, the FBI has used infiltrators to collect information on politically active citizens. Informers are often active participants, helping to develop the direction and policy of the organizations they infiltrate. Frequently, they hold positions of leadership. The FBI has even formed sham radical organizations in order to attract the people they are interested in watching. In fact, infiltration is so widespread that there can almost be said to be a second left movement in this country, a shadow of the true left, which is funded, staffed, and directed by the FBI. The legal scope of FBI operations has been increasing since its formation in 1924. Political surveillance is handled by the Bureau's Domestic Intelligence Division, which dates its authority from 1939, when President Franklin Delano Roosevelt ordered the FBI to investigate matters relating to espionage and sabotage. So long as J. Edgar Hoover and his successors to the directorship could convince the legislature that the government is in imminent danger of communist subversion, funds could be obtained for extensive programs of domestic surveillance, programs which are subject to only the most minimal review by elected representatives of the people.
As head of the ACLU's political surveillance project, Frank Donner has done extensive research on FBI informers.
The informer should be understood as an instrument for perpetuating a myth. And when I say myth, I mean it in more than a metaphorical sense. A myth that the government of the United States is under a permanent threat of internal subversion.
Ron Dellums, a congressman from California, and member of the House Select Committee to investigate the intelligence community, has publicly questioned the legitimacy of FBI activity in this area.
I'm sure at one time that that Berkeley had more agents in Berkeley than we probably had agents in Moscow because of the sick mentality in this country of who is the enemy. The enemy is anybody who opposes the policies of the administration, and we use the forces, have used the forces, and I think the documentation is clearly there, the FBI, the CIA, and other agencies to harass, intimidate, infiltrate, perhaps even assassinate, kidnap, and engage in many, many other insane and very cruel acts.
I grew up thinking that the FBI and the police were the good guys, that their job was to protect, me and mine.
The informer is a key factor in the development of files. That is, the way in which informers' reports are processed by agents on an individual, organizational, and incident level, so as to strengthen the file system. And of course, the file system is extremely important because it's used to support the intelligence thesis that social unrest is produced by individual conspiratorial bad men, cunning and ruthless. It's an attempt to individuate what are fundamentally social problems.
Mary Jo Cook infiltrated the Buffalo, New York chapter of Vietnam Veterans Against the War Winter Soldier Organization.
One of the things that I was very worried about after watching the Watergate testimony was the security of the information that I was passing, because I had passed so much information. I wanted to know whether or not the people that I informed on would be hurt through that. And I respected those people, and I was very concerned. I wanted to know how much of the information was being sent to Washington, who was going to use it, how it was going to be used. And the answers that I got were not satisfactory. I'd worked for them in what I felt to be an honest capacity, and I'd learned through a whole process of working for them that I could not trust them, that even if they felt they were being honest, that they were lying to themselves a lot, and that they were not being responsible as members of a law enforcement agency, that they were helping to set up their apparatus for 1984, and they didn't even care.
Ralph Stein can guess how much of this information reached Washington. In 1967 and 68, he headed a new left desk for Army intelligence. In that capacity, he processed informers' reports and exchanged files with the FBI and other government agencies.
Some of the information which we received, which is so intensely personal and so violative of virtually any definition of First Amendment rights, that at the time we all began to realize, most of us did anyway, that we were really acquiring the apparatus of a police state.
The First Amendment of the Constitution of the United States of America. Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or of the press, or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances.
Much of what we now know about FBI infiltration comes from the confessions of former informants and career agents. Internal FBI memoranda provide another source of information. In 1971, files were stolen from the Bureau's office in Media, Pennsylvania, by a group calling itself the Citizens Commission to Investigate the FBI. Information contained in those files has enabled other investigators to obtain more documents by suing the Bureau under the Freedom of Information Act. The heavily censored documents turned over by the FBI as a result of those suits revealed the existence of extensive domestic counterintelligence programs. Called COINTELPROs, they used legal and illegal methods to infiltrate, disrupt, and harass politically active citizens.
Congressman Ron Dellums reads from one of these documents.
Counterintelligence program, internal security, disruption of the new left. our nation is undergoing an era of disruption and violence caused to a large extent by various individuals generally connected with the New Left. Some of these activities urge revolution in America and call for the defeat of the United States in Vietnam. They continually and falsely allege police brutality and do not hesitate to utilize unlawful acts to further their so-called causes. The New Left has on many occasions viciously and scurrilously attacked the director of the FBI in an attempt to hamper our investigation of it and to drive us off the college campuses. With this in mind, it is our recommendation that a new counterintelligence program be designed to neutralize the New Left and the key activists. The key activists are those individuals who are the moving forces behind the New Left and on whom we have intensified our investigation, the New Left. I think when you get into those kind of labels, there's awesome potential to abuse people. And so you take this kind of statement and you move against any organization that any informant or any agent or any person out there says is a New Left group, you automatically says that equals danger, that equals violence, and then you justify a massive program to infiltrate these organizations. Now, what is the role of the government to do this?
Legislative committees have tried to answer that question. In September 1975, Senator Frank Church questioned the former chief of the FBI's Domestic Intelligence Division about former FBI Director Hoover's approval of the large-scale investigation of American college students.
Can you clarify for me which techniques that you're stating the director approved, which would have been illegal?
Well, there were a number of activities included. B of these activities was opening cases on approximately 4,000 black student activists, all members of the black student unions and similar groups, regardless of their past or present involvement in disorders. And it involved the opening cases on approximately 6,500 New Left student activists, black and white, to determine whether they have a propensity for violence. Now, how do you investigate a person to find out whether he has a propensity for violence?
How do you investigate a propensity for violence? The FBI's answer is to flood targeted groups with informers who often act as provocateurs.
First agent I ever knew was in SDS, and he was a provocateur. So I didn't trust him, work with him. I thought he was crazy. And so did almost everybody else in the SDS chapter. He was just someone who was just always running his mouth off about... You know, we would want to demonstrate someplace and he'd want to blow it up, only he wanted to blow up a dorm.
David Sanis worked for the FBI in the Seattle area.
If anybody seemed interested in violent solutions, I was out advocating, telling him how to do it, and hoping to get people to want to become involved in it.
From 1968 until 1970, Thomas Tongyai toured college campuses in upstate New York preaching revolutionary violence. Undergraduates and high school students knew him as Tommy the Traveler and thought he was a regional traveler for SDS. Tommy gave bizarre, contradictory cover stories, constantly promoted violent activities, and never took part in political discussions. In 1970, the ROTC building at Hobart College in Geneva, New York, was bombed. Four freshmen who had taken part in planning sessions with Tommy were arrested for that action. This is one of those students.
Tommy, first thing, mentioned that if we wanted to have any black powder, he could supply it. He said, well, if you want black powder, I can get it. And he also said that he would show us if we wanted to learn how to make the bombs. And it was sort of strange because the meeting was such a general type of meeting with no desire to have any sort of definite plan, just discussion. And Tommy said, no, we have to set up a plan. He wanted to get the group involved in planning times and planning a definite date for an action.
Tommy the Traveler gave special attention to Clarence Young, chairman of the Black Student Union at Hobart.
A couple of times he offered, like, to give me firebombs to blow up a building on campus, to get guns for me. He said, well, whenever you black students on campus are going to take over a building, I can get the guns for you because I know how to get them. I know where to get them. They won't cost you anything. And it's about time he started doing this.
Washington calling counter-spy.
Harding, counter-spy, calling Washington.
Thomas Edward Mosier was well known to activists at Stanford University and around Palo Alto, California. When he arrived at Stanford in 1969, he presented impressive radical credentials. He had worked with SNCC in Mississippi, with the SDS Join Project in Chicago, and had visited Cuba with SDS in 1968. In 1971, Mosher told a Senate Internal Security Subcommittee that he had acted as an FBI informant under Agent Philip Duncan in Palo Alto.
Herb Borak of the Pacific Studies Center describes Mosher's activities as an FBI provocateur.
He used his contacts, his friendships, associations with different organizations to enhance his credibility with other organizations. He was around people in the SDS National Office in Chicago, which names he could use in working with radicals, with people who thought they were radicals in the Stanford community and with the Panthers. According to his testimony and from observation of people in the area, he was active in the organizing around the United Front Against Fascism in the summer of 1969. People have said that he did offer them dynamite or different kinds of guns. And if you read between the lines in his testimony, it appears that his house, at least, served as a conduit for plastic explosives. He was responsible for using land in the Santa Cruz Mountains for groups to practice guerrilla training. And he mentions bringing people who were in the Revolutionary Union up to the land for this kind of practice.
Most undercover operatives begin informing in exchange for immunity from prosecution or for charges to be dropped. When their identity is discovered, it is usually the result of an accident or when they testify for the prosecution at political trials. A few, like David Sanis, are recruited with appeals to their patriotism. After several years as an informer, Sanis decided he could best serve his country if he stopped working for the FBI and started investigating it.
David Sanis spoke to Bruce Soloway in 1971.
I was asked to by the FBI, specifically Bert Carter, special agent and working out of the Seattle office, to commit a violent felony crime. He said it was definitely necessary to establish my credibility as a violent revolutionary. As a result, in late October, I began to hector people about that I had met five people who claimed to be revolutionaries, that if they were really revolutionaries, they ought to be doing a violent action. I finally convinced a group of people, these five, to work with me to set up a bombing. We planned it out mutually, that is, the FBI and I.
What did you decide to do?
To bomb the Evergreen Point Bridge in the city of Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
Agent Bert Carter finally set the final plan as to not damage the bridge, conduct a bombing in which the individual who actually placed the explosive device would be killed in a booby-trapped explosion.
What was the explanation he gave for why that should be part of the plot?
So that the bridge would not be damaged and disrupt traffic flow, so that I would have credibility yet as a bomber, and that this individual would have died in a bombing attempt and thus would have given pause perhaps to other bombers.
How far along did this plan proceed?
Right up until it was absolutely mapped out and ready to be set in the first week of December when I severed my relationship with the FBI.
I grew up thinking that the FBI and the police were the good guys, that their job was to protect, me and mine.
Although it's been getting away with it for years, the FBI's authority for investigating such legally constituted mass organizations as black student unions or the Socialist Workers Party is open to question. This uncertainty might promote the use of provocateurs. Conspiracy to bomb a federal building or transport explosives across state lines is clearly within the FBI's jurisdiction. Provocateurs are also used to shape the public image of political activists as armed and dangerous maniacs who must be sought out and subdued by the FBI.
You know, a person's first reaction to finding out that they're in an organization which is being watched is, well, why are they watching us? I mean, we're not doing anything illegal, which is true. We weren't and we're not. And, of course, they have to understand why, and people have to explain it to them. You know, why is the state, you know, paying so much attention to an organization whose work is, you know, is public work? And when you get into that, you get into the whole area of what is a state that looks like it's free, unquote, but in fact is extremely repressive.
In 1973, 8 members of Vietnam Veterans Against the War were brought to trial on charges that they conspired to incite, promote, and participate in a riot at the 1972 Republican National Convention.
And we'll come back to this radio documentary produced in the late 70s by Addie Gevins called Me and My Shadow, about the FBI's counterintelligence program. This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman as we continue with Addie Givens, Me and My Shadow, a Pacifica documentary exploring the FBI's assault on the American Indian Movement, anti-Vietnam War groups, and the Black Panther Party.
In 1973, 8 members of Vietnam Veterans Against the War were brought to trial on charges that they conspired to incite, promote, and participate in a riot at the 1972 Republican National Convention.
Richard Boyle covered that trial for KSAN Radio in San Francisco.
We learned, I think, a lot about the psychology of an agent from the Gainesville conspiracy trial. It turned out in testimony at the trial that they were in fact set up by the government. And they were all found not guilty. They were all acquitted by a jury. The key government witness was William Leamer, who held a high-ranking position in the Vietnam Veteran Against the War. He was regional coordinator for 2 states. And at the same time, while working for the FBI as a paid informer, it turned out later that agents had run 3 of the regions in the South. And Scott Camille, one of the defendants, his region, Florida, his deputy was an agent. So to say there was massive infiltration. In fact, it turned out in the trial that the New Orleans chapter had more agents in it than non-agents. Leamer was recruited when somebody shot at him, missed his head by about a foot, and he went to the FBI, and the FBI said that military intelligence had tried to kill him. However, they would protect him from military intelligence if he'd worked for them. So in fact, they used the stick and the carrot. The stick will blow your brains out. And they told him, well, it's MI that's doing it, military intelligence, not us, you know. And they so terrified him, and they did all sorts of other dirty tricks on him. They messed with this woman. They just barraged him with dirty tricks and psychological bombardment to soften him up, to get him to work for him. However, it turned out later he went back to work for the vets, so he became an effective triple agent. This often happens, that agents are so flaky that they go back and they switch back and forth, sometimes 4 or 5 times, so nobody really knows who they're working for.
Scott Camille, one of the defendants in that trial, has received special attention from federal authorities.
Scott was a national leader of the Vietnam Veterans Against the War, and he was looked upon as a threat by the agents who had seized leadership of many high positions in that organization. And so, consequently, the government tried to set him up. They had a man named Manny Fernandez try to sell him Uzi machine guns. It turned out later Manny Fernandez was working for the FBI, and he was offered $700 a month to work for CREEP, Committee to Reelect the President. Scott had already suspected that these people were agents. He knew Leamer had confessed that he was an agent. So Scott said, no thanks, but he got indicted anyway. Then he was found not guilty, as the other 7 defendants were. And Scott decided to do a book on agent infiltration into the Vietnam Veterans Against the War. And he had names and photographs of many agents who are now in key leadership positions in that organization. After he'd been working on the book for about a year, he was stopped by two narcotics agents, shot in the back, and later those agents went through his house, seized his documents, seized his photographs, and all materials relating to that, to his investigation.
There was something in the paper about a woman that he was living with.
Yeah. She turned out to be an agent. The government often uses women or men to get involved in personal relationships with their target and try and win their confidence. And this is apparently what happened to Scott. Scott's second in command in the Florida chapter of the VVW, Florida region, I'm sorry, was an agent. And he admitted being an agent the last day of the trial. The night before, that same agent had sat in on a defense meeting. Agents worm their way into your personal life. They often go to great lengths to establish credibility and then turn on you at the last moment.
God is watching. This I know is true. God is watching. God is watching you. God is watching.
The civil rights movement, which J. Edgar Hoover frequently described as a collection of communist front organizations, was kept under close surveillance by the FBI. As a more militant black movement began to develop in this country, an ever-broadening FBI shadow accompanied it.
Ron Dillams reads from an FBI document which details a COINTELPRO program directed towards what the FBI characterizes as black nationalist hate groups.
To all special agents in charge, from the director of the FBI, entitled Counterintelligence Programs, Black Nationalist Hate Groups, Racial Intelligence, to prevent the rise of a messiah who could unify and electrify the militant black nationalist movement. Blank might be such a messiah. He is the mortar of the movement. That may be Malcolm X or so. Blank, blank, and blank all aspire to this position. Blank is less of a threat because of his age. Blank would be a very real contender for this position should he abandon his supposed obedience to white liberal doctrines, nonviolence, and embrace black nationalism. That may very well be Dr. Martin Luther King, who was an advocate of nonviolence. And they said, Blank has the necessary charisma to be a real threat in this way.
David Du Bois, editor-in-chief of the Intercommunal News Service of the Black Panther Party, discusses the relationship of the FBI to that organization.
There is a host of evidence suggesting the active participation and involvement of paid agents, informers, and contract agents of the various intelligence services of this country, alleged intelligence services of this country, their participation in the activities of the party as members and as leaders.
Lewis Tackwood worked as an undercover informer for the criminal conspiracy section of the Los Angeles Police Department. He claims that he also worked for the FBI. In November 1971, Tackwood testified at the trial of 13 Panther Party members in Los Angeles. That trial stemmed from a 1969 attack on Black Panther headquarters by an FBI-trained SWAT team of the Los Angeles Police Department.
The chief prosecution witness in that trial was Melvin Cotton Smith, a leading member of the L.A. Panthers at the time of the alleged shootout.
U.S. Deputy District Attorney Ronald H. Carroll maintained that Smith had turned state's evidence to avoid prosecution. Tackwood testified that Smith had been an informer since 1969.
Lewis Tackwood's testimony revealed an insider's view of the extent of FBI infiltration.
District Attorney Carroll asked me, I think, one question. What did I know about the Panther Party at the present time? And I think I asked him which one, either the police department's Panther Party or the Panther Party, you know.
There are mountains of evidence that those individuals, some of whom have been revealed, others of whom have not, acted in ways to provoke confrontations between the party and the police and other armed elements of the power structure. The Black Panther Party considers 26 members, former members, as martyrs, having fallen in the course of the struggle, the history of this organization.
Fred Hampton, a Black Panther Party leader, was killed in December 1969 when his apartment was raided by Chicago police. In a suit brought by his family against the FBI and the Chicago Police Department, Hampton's death is attributed to an FBI operative who was serving as his bodyguard.
Rick Wagner of the Center for Constitutional Rights is working on that suit.
With Fred Hampton, we found out as a factual matter that the FBI agent who was the head of COINTELPRO in Chicago had provided the Chicago Police Department with completely fabricated evidence, quote unquote, suggesting that Fred Hampton had been responsible for the killing of a police officer in Chicago several weeks previous to the raid on Fred Hampton's apartment. Clearly, that was calculated to enrage an already generally enraged police department, provided the police department with the pretext of raiding Fred Hampton's apartment, which was suggesting to them that they were keeping illegal weapons on the premises, and that Fred Hampton's bodyguard, a man whose name was O'Neill, who had drugged Fred Hampton the night before the raid, was in fact an FBI, not a Chicago police, but an FBI informer who reported directly to the FBI agent.
There's something happening here. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there, telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. There's battle lines being drawn. Nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speak in their minds, are getting so much resistance from behind. Time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's
Sleepy
going
Bailey,
down.
United Prisoners Union.
I think at this point, you know, in the United States, that more than the pigs trying to kill somebody that's in a leadership position in an organization, I think the main thing that infiltrators do, or the pigs try to do now, is to split organizations and in that way just crush them, just divide them up into little pieces until they're like little slivers and little sects, you know. Because a lot of times when a leader of an organization is killed, or somebody like George Jackson is killed, what happens there is that death just means birth for a lot of other people. And the pigs don't want that. They'd rather just, you know, an organization totally collapse and disappear.
Peter Camejo, presidential candidate, Socialist Workers' Party.
I think if you go back and look at the way SNCC was destroyed, you look at some of the things that happened to the Black Panther Party, you look at some of the problems we had in the anti-war movement of artificial divisions and forces that could have united to fight together against the war, you will find the hand of the policeman, the agent, the provocateur, the CIA or FBI agent at work.
For 2 years, Mary Jo Cook was an active member of the Buffalo, New York chapter of Vietnam Veterans Against the War Winter Soldier Organization. In April 1975, she admitted that she was an FBI informer, but claimed that she had been converted by the politics of the group she was informing on.
Chuck Smith.
I came from the New York region of VVAW WSO, and I knew Mary Jo Cook for the full 2 years that she was in the organization as an informer. I used to talk to her a lot, and a lot of times she really turned me off because of the way she talked about other people. But in general, I thought quite highly of her because she was doing a lot of hard work. She would talk about other people behind their backs in ways that would tend to set you against them for some reason. She would give you a negative idea of their practice or of their political views.
In debriefing Mary Jo, members of the Buffalo chapter discovered that the FBI was extremely interested in an internal political struggle that was developing in the chapter. Cook had obviously been manipulated to encourage this split. The FBI told her that they would no longer be interested in members of the chapter if it left the national organization. Ultimately, it did.
Chuck Smith.
Because of the political struggle over focus in VVAWWSO. There was a sort of a split between the regional coordinator and the chapter, and she really played on that to the detriment of the regional coordinator.
Rick Wagner.
The government takes advantage of splits within the left at every possible opportunity to widen them, to make them less reconcilable. And clearly they contribute to those splits. And the important thing about that is that those of us who are on the left, to raising our differences to the high levels that we have, we are objectively serving the interests of the state.
Are you beginning to feel a bit paranoid? The FBI hopes that you are.
This is an excerpt from one of the internal documents stolen from the Bureau's Media Pennsylvania office.
There was a pretty general consensus that more interviews with these subjects and hangers-on are in order for plenty of reasons, chief of which are it will enhance the paranoia endemic in these circles and will further serve to get the point across there is an FBI agent behind every mailbox. In addition, some will be overcome by the overwhelming personalities of the contacting agent and volunteer to tell all, perhaps on a continuing basis.
For years, political surveillance programs of the FBI and other agencies were aimed chiefly at anti-war groups. In the early 1970s, testimony in trials and before legislative committees has revealed that the major targets now include politically active prisoners and prisoner support organizations. Mark Schwartz, a reporter who specializes in prison-related issues, discusses what transpired before a special investigative committee of the California State Legislature.
In 1974, there was a whole series of hearings before State Senator Harmer. Six witnesses testified. They were only identified as witness one through six. Most of them were prisoners. A couple were from the so-called Special Services SS Division of the Department of Corrections. These people testified against attorneys who have been coming into prison. They testified against various organizations on the outside that have tried to show support for prisoners. They made strong statements against revolutionary radicals, just denouncing the entire left movement, naming names, etc. Red baiting, a typical Joe McCarthy type thing. This is where it's at now in 1975. Instead of red baiting people who support Russia, you are red baiting people who support prisoners.
Since the Department of Corrections has complete control over the future of an inmate or parolee, many prisoners can be manipulated to testify against their friends.
I think one of the most famous cases is the case of the Venceremos organization down in the South San Francisco Bay Area, who had for a long time supported a prisoner by the name of Ronald Beatty. Beatty escaped from a Southern California prison a couple of years ago. At the time of his escape, they printed an article in Venceremos saying that this revolutionary comrade Beatty had escaped and deserves the support of the people. And then I think it was a very short time thereafter that Beatty was arrested. And immediately it was clear that Beatty was going to set up the Venceremos organization as helping him break out of prison. And a guard was killed in the process of that breakout. So the next issue of Venceremos, they said, Beatty, enemy of the people. You know, well, if this didn't cause confusion...
An excerpt of Me and My Shadow, produced by Addie Gevins, about the FBI's assault on many anti-war, Black Panther Party, and American Indian Movement groups.
Oh,